This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal.
Regain, powered by BetterHelp, offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd tried couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
What's the most terrifying and scary story from your life that you want to confess? Story one. Let me start off by saying this will be a long read. I'm also going to tell you that what I'm about to type is something I've carried with me for the last 24 years, and I haven't really spoken much about it since I was a child. I've never spoken about it on any kind of public forum such as this. You are free to not believe me. In fact, I encourage you to doubt anything that you're told from anyone. I'm typing this message because as I've gotten older and spent over 2 decades building a life to the best of my ability, I've carried an immense weight on my shoulders that neither therapist nor psychiatrist has treated as anything other than a method of repressing memories at best, or the delusions of a disturbed person at worst. I do not blame you if you draw those same conclusions. I'm typing this in what I believe has become the most widely used place on the internet to speak freely, for the sole purpose of attempting to drop the weight I've carried and move on with my life. This is more of a personal cleanse than an attempted intrigue. And if no one reads this message and it becomes buried among the countless posts online, I will have at least gotten it off my chest. I am not from here. And by here, I don't mean where I currently live. I mean where any of us live. Anyone reading this right now. It's now a few days after my 30th birthday, and this time of year always strikes me because I started kindergarten on my birthday when I turned 5. I thought, at the time, everyone did that. You turn 5. And when you turned 5, you went to school. I didn't realize my birthday just happened to coincide with the first day of school. And a little over 1 year later, in about 2 weeks' time, it will have been 24 years to the day that my entire world vanished. I was born in San Diego and lived in a poorer suburb of San Diego as a child. I lived in an apartment complex called Lemon Vine Apartments, which was a slightly run-down version of the Lemon Vine Apartments found in Lemon Grove, a suburb of San Diego. My parents were divorced but friendly. My mother was young when she had me, and she was beautiful. She was in her early 20s and was aspiring to be a model, regularly taking trips to LA to do photo shoots. She did glamour modeling for magazines. She had a darker skin tone, being one quarter Indian, not Native American, and it gave her an exotic look. My favorite picture of her as a child was her modeling a luxurious wedding dress for a bridal company. I used to sleep with that picture when she would go to LA, and I would stay with my dad, who worked for the city of San Diego. They shared custody pretty evenly, and we even did Christmas together as a family, even though they had split when I was still a baby. My dad, his girlfriend, my mom, who was single, and me. Maybe things weren't as good between them as I remember, but I was 6, so if there was drama behind the scenes, they did a good job of hiding it from me. On September 17th, 1996, I was staying with my dad's parents in Riverside, California. They had a small farm where they raised chickens, pigs, and goats. No horses or sheep or anything. But my grandma had several pet ducks that would eat seed from your hand, fly away, and return every year like clockwork. My dad had to work nights for a week, and my mom was in LA, so I stayed with my grandparents. Schools back then were pretty relaxed about this kind of thing, and I was sent home with the sorts of light assignments you'd expect of a first grader who'd just returned to school after summer break. The 17th was the third day I was staying with my grandparents, and my grandpa had warned me to be careful outside because he'd seen a rattlesnake and wasn't sure where it had gone. So since no one knew where the mystery snake had disappeared to, six-year-old me decided to go hunting for it. In hindsight, letting a six-year-old roam around a farm looking for a rattlesnake probably wasn't in any parenting handbook, but it was the 90s, and I guess they didn't actually expect me to find it. There were woods on the property, but I wasn't allowed to go in there, so they probably figured that's where the snake had gone. I spent all day outside playing Jungle Explorer on the farm, trying to track down this rattlesnake. And much to my excitement, when I opened the well house, which for those who don't know, looks kind of like one of the green electrical boxes on the side of the road, there it was, curled up, rattling away. I immediately slammed the door shut and ran to my grandparents' house to tell them I'd found it. Now, this might be my six-year-old memory exaggerating, but I'm pretty sure that snake was at least 900 feet long, give or take. I found it, though. I was excited to tell my grandpa so he could do what he did and go out and shoot the thing. I ran in the back door of the house, which led into the laundry room, and through the kitchen. I paid no mind to anything until I turned left and entered the living room, expecting to see my grandparents, my uncle, and the neighbor couple all sitting in the living room where I'd left them. Except they weren't there, and it wasn't the same living room anymore. The furniture was completely wrong. The hard and memorably uncomfortable hardwood furniture my grandpa loved so much was gone. The coffee table he made out of a tree stump was gone, replaced by fluffy grandma-looking furniture. A three-person sofa with a floral design on it, the TV was in the wrong place, and newer than my grandpa's old sit-on-the-ground cabinet TV. The hardwood paneling on the walls was gone, or at least covered by blue wallpaper. The hardwood floor was a shaggy off-white carpet. The pictures of my dad, my uncle, me, and my grandparents were gone from the walls, replaced by paintings and photos of people I didn't know. As confused as I was by this, I was more confused by everyone being missing. In my six-year-old brain, I accepted that they may have completely rearranged the house while I'd spent the day looking for a snake, but I didn't believe they'd all just leave me alone. And I hadn't seen anyone leave. I didn't see the cars go down the road. So I walked out the front door, which was attached to the living room, as they usually are, and thought maybe they'd gone to the chickens or the pigs. Both should have been visible from the front porch, but the chicken coop was gone, and the pig pen had lost its fencing, and there were no pigs to be found. At this point, I was beyond confused and getting very scared. I didn't want to be alone, and I didn't see anyone. Even though they lived on a small farm, the neighbors that had been visiting lived just across the dirt road, so I ran down our driveway and across the road to their house, assuming that must be where they'd gone. I remember getting more and more scared as I ran to their house, and I remember starting to cry when their house was the wrong color. It wasn't the faded yellow house it used to be. It wasn't even the right house anymore. Nevertheless, I banged on the door. I remember that at this point, I was crying quite hard because I didn't understand what was happening, and I kept wiping my face, which was covered in dirt after having been digging around under stumps and logs for snakes all day. When the door opened and a woman in her late 40s to early 50s answered, and I'd never seen her before, I just started bawling uncontrollably. Everything after this point is largely a blur because nothing was right. I knew where I lived. I knew where I went to school, I knew where my grandparents lived, but I met the people who lived where my grandparents lived, and they were not my grandparents. I did not know them. I begged for them to get my uncle, to tell them who I was, but my uncle wasn't there. Through a series of police and people in suits, I was brought back to the town I lived in after spending what felt like 10 hours in the local police station trying to contact my parents. I had my home phone number memorized but told them my dad would be asleep. But when they called that number, the person on the other end had no idea who I was or what they were talking about. I was asked to give the officers my address and sat in the local police station while officers in my hometown went to that address. When they finally called the station back, they were informed that the name of the apartment complex was incorrect. Lemon Vine Apartments didn't exist, and the address I gave them belonged to a complex called Merritt Manor. The apartment number I gave them was unoccupied. I believe at this point they assumed I had given them the wrong name and number, but I knew I lived there. When I was finally brought to my hometown, after changing hands a couple of times between police, I was asked to give my address again and was driven to where I said I lived. That was it. That was my apartment complex. But just like everything else, it looked wrong. It was painted a different color, and the sign that used to have a large image of a lemon reading Lemon Vine now read Merritt Manor. I took the police to exactly where I lived, and just as they'd said, no one lived there. From this point forward, the police attempted to contact neighbors, all of whom knew me, but none of them were who they were supposed to be. Every person who came out of the nearby buildings was the wrong person, and they didn't know me. They tried to contact my father, which should have been easy since he worked for the city, but no employee by his name apparently worked for the city in any capacity. As day turned to night, and I spent endless hours sitting in the police station while they tried to find anyone who knew me, I couldn't do anything but cry. A woman in a suit, either a detective or someone who worked there, sat with me for several hours and tried to keep me calm. She gave me a stuffed dog, a Dalmatian puppy that looked like one from 101 Dalmatians, and told me his name was Sparky. She said I could keep Sparky, and that when they found my parents, Sparky would go home with me and make sure I didn't get lost again. She said he was a good dog and he'd protect me if I took care of him. During this time, they tried my school. I told them I went to Shawnee Elementary. It was close to where I lived. But again, no such school existed.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal.
Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. They aren't affected by tariffs because their clothing products never left the U.S. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
My school was apparently now called Anza Elementary. At one point, I was asked if the police had ever taken my fingerprints. And they had. In kindergarten, our entire class had our fingerprints taken at the school gym, basically for this kind of situation. Unsurprisingly, this didn't help at all. They couldn't find my parents, or my grandparents, or my neighbors, or my apartment, or even me. I was too young to remember my social security number, but I doubt it would have mattered. I gave them my birthday and any other info that could help, but nothing came up. At one point, I was taken to the ER because they suspected I might have suffered a head injury, but I was fine. I was sent back. I ended up staying with someone that night. I'm not entirely sure who it was. Someone from child services, I imagine. I couldn't stop crying long enough to really focus on what was happening after this point. I'd cried myself to sleep several times in the police station and cried myself to sleep again at the house I stayed at that night, despite the woman who was caring for me, not the same one who gave me Sparky, doing everything in her power to calm me. I clung to Sparky so tightly I'm surprised I didn't tear him apart. I didn't have my picture of my mom. I didn't know what was going on, and no one could figure out where I belonged. This didn't make sense to me. I was only 6, barely. I lived where I lived, and my parents were my parents, and my school was my school. They didn't just disappear one day. In between crying fits and waking up, I begged to go home. I begged the woman to call my dad again. I just kept begging to go home. Over the next few days, I was questioned by many people at different times, in different places, and at all hours. Police, investigators, people from departments I didn't recognize, child psychologists, everyone under the sun was asking me questions. I was taken back and forth between the police station and the house where I was staying, until eventually someone told me they thought they had located my parents and they were coming to get me. Finally, I was going home. Finally, this nightmare was over. Finally, I could get away from all of these strangers asking me the same questions again and again. But when the couple showed up to the police station, my heart sank into my feet. They were not my parents. They had lost a son who went missing, and I fit his description closely. The woman began crying when she saw me, because she immediately knew I wasn't her missing son, but I had no tears left to cry. Eventually, I was taken into foster care. I stayed with a foster family for a few months. The police launched a campaign asking for anyone to come forward with information about me. They took my photo at the station to run in the newspapers and on the local news. I never let go of Sparky for even a second. They didn't want me to hold him in the photo because I didn't have him when I arrived, but I needed him. I would throw a huge tantrum whenever someone tried to take him. They made me put back on the clothes I was wearing when I was found, even though they had since given me new ones. During those months at the foster home, parents of missing children came to see me. I didn't realize what was happening until I was older. They didn't come right out and say, "Is this your kid?" They were more subtle. The parents would visit and meet me. And when they realized I wasn't their missing child, they often left in tears. Looking back at all these families that came hoping I was their child, it breaks my heart. It's a feeling I can't describe. A kind of guilt, like I wish I could have been their child, just so they'd have closure, just so someone would be safe. Most of them probably never saw their children again, but I try to imagine they did, that all of them were reunited, even though I know it's unlikely. That guilt is one of the things that kept me in therapy as an adult. But like I said, no therapist has ever believed my story. The most common theory I hear is that I was abandoned, lived in an abusive home, and was dumped in the middle of nowhere. That I repressed all my early memories. I didn't stay in that foster home permanently. Eventually, even though my case wasn't officially closed, I had to start school, and I needed identification. I was issued a birth certificate for the year I told them I was born, but the date listed was September 17th, the day I was found. I never understood why they didn't use the actual day and month I gave them, but maybe they thought I didn't really know it. My name was unchanged. I started going to school again, but only part-time at first. One of the psychologists who had seen me recommended that I not be placed in a full curriculum immediately, suspecting I had PTSD. I was put in a special class and only had to attend twice a week initially. Eventually, I went back to school full-time and moved through a few more foster homes. I can't say exactly how long it was before it happened, but eventually I was placed for adoption. No one ever told me directly that I was up for adoption, so I don't know how soon after I was found.
Looking to buy your dream home or rent that perfect apartment? With the Redfin app, you'll know the moment your next place hits the market. Set up your gotta-have-it wish list, and Redfin will send you real-time notifications for properties that match. And when you're ready to see it in person, scheduling a tour is just a tap away. Thinking about selling? Redfin can do that too. In fact, Redfin agents close twice as many deals as other agents, so they know how to get the best price for your home. And with a listing fee as low as 1%, Redfin charges half of what others often charge. So you could save big, like really big. Last year, Redfin saved home sellers $118 million. So whether you're buying, renting, or selling, Redfin's ready to help you win. Download the Redfin app and start searching today.
It happened. But eventually, people came to meet me. These weren't parents looking for their missing child. They were people looking to adopt. But I wasn't a good candidate. I told stories no one believed, insisted my parents would find me, and cried almost daily until my eyes hurt. This story doesn't have a happy ending. I never saw my parents again. I was a ward of the state until I turned 18, and my life went nowhere after that. My teens were filled with problems. I spent some time in a facility for youth in San Diego called Chaparral. I never went to college. I didn't start getting my life together until I was around 24. I haven't talked publicly about this before now, not since I was a child being questioned by everyone trying to figure out where I came from. I still have Sparky. He's old and worn, but still in one piece. No longer white, he's now a dark shade of gray. He sits on my dresser, and he's there, just like he always has been for as long as I've been here. Story 2, my experiences as a crime scene cleaner. To start off, you need a little backstory to explain how I got into this situation. When I got out of high school around 2003, finding a job was difficult, so I took whatever unpleasant jobs I could to get by. When I found a job cleaning fire and water damage full-time, I was excited to have steady income and start saving. But this quickly turned into a nightmare that I had to endure for almost 2 years. The company I worked for put me on my first job, which was a water damage claim where a basement had flooded with sewage. After a few days of work, we finished and moved on to the next job. My boss then called me into his office the next morning and told me about a special crew he was setting up. He asked if I would be the crew leader supervising three other guys who had just been hired. I found this strange as I had only been working there for about 3 days, but figured my work ethic was already paying off and maybe I'd get a raise. I only made $10 an hour to start. Not only did I not get a raise, but I also received no training in the new position, just a work van with cleaning materials and the phone numbers for the three new guys who were also hired to do fire and water damage cleanup. The boss told me what tools were best to use and what cleaning products would sanitize properly, along with where everything was located in the van, including hazmat suits and respirators. But he was vague about what kind of things I'd be cleaning up. He said the situations were always different, and I would receive detailed instructions for each job. He called my position CSC crew leader. He assured me that I would never have to see any deceased individuals, as the coroner would have the remains removed before we arrived, and that I should use my best judgment to determine what needed to be removed from homes and what could be clean. The first job in my new position was cleaning up after an elderly person had passed away in their home and had been left in a chair. When we arrived, the coroner had me come inside to show me a few things considered hazardous materials that needed to be removed due to the risk of disease. I guess my boss had connections with the county coroner's office, and much of our work came through their recommendations. Not only was the deceased still in the house, but the body was fully visible to me and another worker. You could smell the rot through the mass as the house had no air conditioning, and it was mid-June. The coroner was backed up and waiting for additional help to load the body, which was falling apart. I call the body it because I honestly couldn't tell if it was male or female and was trying not to look too long, as it was disturbing. The other three guys I worked with handled it well, but two got sick from the smell and had to go outside to vomit. We all waited outside after the coroner showed us the chair, the fluids that had leaked into the carpet, and the basement where the fluids had seeped through the subfloor and puddled on some boxes. Once the coroner's team removed the deceased, we got to work. After about 5 minutes, strange things started to happen, starting with the chair. I had removed the back of the chair and was putting it into the special hazmat bags when the base started to rock. I was about 10 feet away at the time, placing the bag by the front door. No one else was in the same room. The other guys were in the basement moving boxes. I brushed it off and took apart the base of the chair as much as I could. When I got it into the bag, I got a chill up my back and began feeling sick. I figured it was just the shock of what I was cleaning, even though the chill was odd considering how hot I was in full hazmat gear in the middle of June. Next, I removed the carpet and assessed the floor to see if it could be cleaned or if I'd need to remove a section. I called my boss and he told me to pour the special cleaner on the area to soak into the floorboards. I went to the truck to retrieve it and brought it inside. When I came back in, all three guys were scrambling out of the basement, tripping over each other, and running outside. When I asked what was going on, they said someone was in the cluttered basement. They assumed it was a homeless person or drug user. Detroit has many problems like that. I listened at one of the open basement windows. One of the first things we did when we arrived was open every possible window and prop doors open. Maybe someone had gotten inside then or was hiding there before we arrived. After a few minutes of silence, another worker and I went down with a mag light in a metal fence post. We found nothing, just our own footprints from the shoe covers we wore. But when we started up the stairs, we heard a horrible hacking cough from somewhere in the basement. We searched but found nothing, just stirred up dust in a corner like someone had moved things recently. We called the other guys back in, and they returned to the basement to deal with the boxes. But they all said they felt like they were being touched while throwing away materials soaked in fluids. I went back upstairs to clean the floorboards, but the bottle of cleaner I had placed next to them was gone. I was frustrated, as it was the only bottle I had, and I remembered exactly where I had put it, before I was distracted by the guys coming upstairs. I started taking out trash, figuring I'd find it eventually. I found the bottle on its side behind the bag that had the back of the chair. That didn't make sense. There were about 6 other bags in front of that one near the door, and the bottle was a full gallon. Again, I felt a chill, this time followed by what sounded like a whisper. I couldn't make out the words. I cleaned the floorboards and moved out the trash. Job complete. That night, each member of my crew had a dream about an older man telling us we weren't welcome in his home, accusing us of touching his belongings and saying we needed to leave. In my dream, I was alone in the house. The old man cried and told me I was destroying his possessions and couldn't replace them. He tried to push me out, but I ignored him, even when he screamed or shoved me. He threw my cleaner into the trash pile I had made by the front door, exactly where I had found it earlier that day. 2 of the other guys said they had similar dreams. The old man was pushing them as they went through ruined photos and other things that had to be thrown away. They said it felt like they were on autopilot, sad but unable to stop. The thing that stood out to me was that both of them said the man was coughing violently in the dream and grabbing their arms when they touched certain items. None of them had been in the house when I heard the coughing in the basement. The guy who searched the basement with me said he also had a dream, but only remembered waking up sad, as if he had done something wrong, and had a severe coughing fit. That could be a coincidence, but I connected it to the others. We all talked about it and decided it was likely a psychological response to a traumatic situation. I'm really into psychology, so I tried to rationalize it. We hoped for better assignments the next day. The next few jobs weren't so bad. Cleaning up blood after a home invasion. No fatalities, but a mess. And a few other crime scenes with fatalities. But nothing strange happened. About 2 weeks into the job, we started learning the tricks of the trade and split into 2 groups, both under my supervision as crew leader. I thought we were getting used to the work, but I was wrong. The next job that involved unusual activity was a suicide. A middle-aged man had taken his own life. The coroner had already removed the body, but the scene was a mess. Judging by the spray pattern in the basement, what looked like a second living room, he had used either a large caliber handgun or a shotgun. There were skull fragments embedded in the drywall, brain matter spread across the room, and, once again, the smell was overwhelming because he hadn't been found right away. Our first step was to use our backpack vacuum cleaner to collect all biomaterial. The coroner told us that both he and his partner had felt very uneasy in the house and that something about the place felt off. As soon as we stepped into the basement, we also felt a claustrophobic, suffocating sensation. To make matters worse, the man's family was upstairs crying, but the sound of the vacuum helped to drown it out. While I was cleaning, the basement light suddenly went out. It was completely pitch black. That was strange because my vacuum was still running, so power hadn't been lost. Then I heard my crewmate screaming. I turned off my vacuum, climbed off the ladder, and thought maybe he'd hit a wire. But as soon as I turned off the vacuum, his screaming continued, and I heard things being knocked over. I started fumbling for my flashlight on my tool belt and shouted his name, asking what was happening. He didn't answer, just kept screaming. Then in the darkness, I saw something even darker moving toward me. I won't lie, I freaked out. I slipped while backing up, still searching for my flashlight, and finally found it when my back hit the basement wall. I turned on the light and aimed it toward the shape. What I saw was the silhouette of a man wearing a flannel shirt with a beard and a furious expression. He looked like he was about to attack me. Then suddenly he vanished. My crewmate was behind where the figure had been. He was sitting on the floor, rocking back and forth with his hands over his head. When I got to him, he picked up his flashlight from the ground, turned it on, and ran upstairs. Outside, he threw up. I followed, asking if he was okay and why he'd been screaming. At first, I thought maybe I had imagined the dark figure. Maybe it was just fear. But then he told me that while he had been scrubbing the wall, he felt something pulling items from his tool belt. He thought it was me at first. Then the lights went out, and he was engulfed in what he described as dark smoke. He said he immediately couldn't breathe and struggled to move. He managed to pull out his flashlight, but it was knocked from his hand. He said it felt like someone grabbed his wrist. He managed to scream, and when he did, trinkets started falling off the entertainment center, about 3 feet to his side. The smoke seemed to retreat, but he was close to passing out. He also said he temporarily lost his hearing and didn't even know if sound was coming out when he screamed. That's why he was covering his head. Items were falling on him. He said when the smoke backed off, he felt like a weight had been lifted, but he felt instantly sick. and the beam of my flashlight made the nausea worse. We took an early lunch. He just sat there, pale, barely speaking. He told me he felt like he had inhaled the dark smoke and still didn't feel right. I gave him some sports drink, and eventually his color came back. I never told him I'd seen the man in the flannel shirt. I didn't want to suggest it, since he hadn't mentioned seeing anything like that. When we went back in, the basement lights were on again. Half the things that had fallen off the shelves were back in place. The TV was turned on and showing a baseball game. There was also a strange burnt hair smell in the room. My coworker lasted another half hour, then got sick again and went home for the day. That left me alone to finish the job. After vacuuming up the rest of the material, I started scrubbing the dried blood. Once it congeals, especially with brain matter mixed in, it's like glue, even with cleaner. While finishing, I kept seeing the shape of a person in the corner of my eye. Each time, I'd smell that burnt hair scent. A few times, I also felt something tugging on items in my tool belt, though I couldn't tell what. When I was done, I went to use the bathroom upstairs. On the way down the hallway, I heard what sounded like muffled crying or moaning. I froze. I thought maybe one of the family members had come back. When I turned around, no one was there. But I noticed a photo on the wall of a man with a beard wearing a flannel shirt. Several photos along the hall showed him in different flannels, with family, fishing, or hunting. I hadn't seen those photos before. I hadn't been anywhere else in the house, and I avoided the downstairs bathroom because taking off hazmat gear is a hassle. As I was locking up, closing windows, turning off lights, and leaving only the porch light on, I saw the curtain move in the front window. Again, there was that figure, darker than black, standing in the window. The last experience I'll share in this thread happened in mid-July in a particularly rough neighborhood in Detroit. There had been an incident where a man allegedly tried to abduct a child. People in the neighborhood intervened and beat the man severely. He escaped to his home, and neighbors surrounded the house to prevent him from leaving. The police response was delayed. Meanwhile, the crowd threw rocks through his windows and damaged his car. The man was injured, possibly by the crowd or broken glass, and died in his home. According to a police officer, it was likely a misunderstanding. Apparently, the man had picked up an injured girl who'd fallen from her bike, and some local kids misinterpreted the situation and told their parents he was trying to abduct her. The cleanup was straightforward, securing windows, cleaning up blood and bodily fluids. But as soon as I entered the house, I was hit by overwhelming waves of fear and sadness, unlike anything I had ever felt. My legs went weak. My partner, who showed up later and hadn't heard the story, felt it too. Throughout the cleanup, we kept seeing something dart around corners, like a small patch of fog or mist watching us and then hiding. We also heard faint cries for help from several parts of the house. At times, we heard voices saying, "Please stop," or long, painful. When the crowd returned to yell at the house again, the activity inside increased. We heard footsteps running upstairs, doors slamming, and what sounded like the front door opening and closing, though we never saw any doors move. The footsteps followed the same path each time. Front door, living room, bathroom, stairs, then up to the upstairs bungalow. What really shook me was that I could feel the vibrations in the floor, like someone was physically running past me. Each time I felt that impact, another wave of fear and sorrow hit me. When we finally left, a few people were on nearby porches, yelling things at us. This was common in summer, but the hostility was unnerving. We ignored it and began loading the van, removing our hazmat suits. Before we finished, the front door slammed shut with a force that sounded like a gunshot. It startled both of us and even scared the people on the porches. They went inside immediately. Somehow, the deadbolt was locked from the inside, and we couldn't open it. We think it used a different key than the knob, so we ended up leaving a few boards inside that were meant for window repairs. The relief I felt after leaving that house was like night and day. Inside, I had felt anxious, scared, paranoid, and hopeless. Maybe partly due to knowing the story. But the second I stepped outside, it was like flipping a switch. I instantly felt better. My partner and I were joking and laughing again, just two guys in our late teens, being normal. I've written many of these experiences in a journal I started after my third month on the job. I also spoke with the other crew members and gathered their strange stories too. I know some of this might be the mind's way of coping with trauma, but some of it just can't be explained. And when others had similar experiences that I hadn't shared with them yet, that's something different altogether. When I have more time, I'll pull out that journal and share more. Things only got worse after those first 3 months. There were more events I believe were paranormal and many situations that pushed my mental state to the edge. In the end, I worked that job for almost 2 years. All three of the guys I started with are now gone. Two died by suicide, one from a drug overdose that may have been intentional. We'll never know for sure. But what I do know is that when those three guys, 19 or 20 years old, started this job, they were just normal young men. They had dreams, joked around, cared about parties, music, girls, and having a good time. I watched the life slowly drain from each of them. And I know this sounds awful, but every one of them was considerate enough to die in a way that wouldn't leave a horrible mess behind. Maybe because they didn't want someone else to go through what we did. Story 3. In 2012, I suffered a stroke that killed me. As I slipped away, I felt an overwhelming peace come over me, like I had never felt before. Everything went black, and then I was ascending above. I could see the city below. Next to me, I heard a voice coming from an orb made of varied colored lights with a mist gently coming off of it. It was a woman's voice, and she was telling me how excited she was to finally be with her family and see her mom and dad again. I started to feel unsure and told her I wasn't supposed to be here. Suddenly, I was standing in an otherworldly place that was absolutely stunning. All the structures and buildings looked like they were made of marble, but with an iridescent shimmer running through the patterns. The buildings were decorated with colorful stones, gold embellishments, and glass fencing. I walked along a path, arms crossed and holding on to myself. I felt lost. Everyone around me was happily chatting, wearing otherworldly clothes made of satin-like linen. Some people were holding hands, close and joyful with one another. The entire place was beautiful beyond words. I came across an old man sitting under a tree, seemingly teaching a class surrounded by people. Some were sitting, others standing. He called me over to join them. He was teaching about what life on Earth was supposed to be, how humans were meant to care for the world and all its inhabitants, but materialism and other distractions got in the way. As he continued, I felt a flood of knowledge enter me, insight about the world, the universe, life, and death. Then everyone in the class began to gather around me, and the old man placed his hand on my shoulder and said, "It's not your time yet. You will know when it is." Everyone came in close and held me in a circle, and suddenly I was back. I opened my eyes and took a breath. I was alive again, back in my earthly body. This experience is what made me believe in God and also in reincarnation. I don't claim any particular religion now because my beliefs have become a mix of different things. Sadly, over time, the incredible knowledge I felt during that experience has slowly slipped from my mind, but I can still feel it there, tucked away in the back of my consciousness. For me, religion became like different fingers pointing to the same divine being. I don't need a religion to define my relationship with God. In case you're wondering, I'm 27 now and still live with the residual effects of the stroke, which have left me disabled. But I keep going. My body may not function like it used to, but my mind still works. And I focus on expanding my knowledge in various areas. Story 4. So I grew up next door to a kind Polish couple, Ted and Josie. For 19 years, our family loved them, and we considered them like our grandparents. One day, Ted passed away, and then Josie happened to pass 6 months later. About 4 days went by, it was a Friday night, and I was sleeping in my room with my back toward the door when I suddenly woke up. I looked at my alarm clock. It was exactly 1 a.m. As I tried to go back to sleep, I heard the wooden floor creak. Then I felt the bed sink in a little, like someone had sat down behind me. I thought maybe it was one of my sisters coming to bug me about her night out, and I wasn't in the mood to entertain any gossip, so I pretended to be asleep. A few seconds passed, and whoever it was got up and left. The next day I had forgotten all about it and didn't even mention it to my sisters to ask if any of them had come into my room. That night the exact same thing happened again. I fell asleep around 10:30 p.m., and by 1 a.m., I was awake for no reason. Again, I felt someone walk in and sit on the edge of the bed. Now I was a little scared but stayed motionless, pretending to sleep, still facing away from the door. I wasn't going to turn around unless someone spoke or touched me. After a few seconds, the person got up and walked out. I was determined to bring it up the next morning. Now it was Sunday. I remembered what happened and asked my sisters right in front of my mom, if any of them had walked into my room and sat on my bed the last two nights. All three laughed at me and said no. They accused me of imagining things. Then my mom turned around and said, "What if it's Josie's spirit?" I said, "What? No way." She explained that sometimes spirits need a candle lit in their honor so they can follow the light to their final resting place. She suggested maybe no one from Josie's family lit a candle for her during her funeral. I thought it was a strange idea, but if true, I felt honored that she came to me out of our family of six. I told myself that if she came again, I'd turn around and face her. Why not? She was nothing but love and kindness while she was alive. She clearly wasn't visiting to scare or hurt me. I got bold, promised myself I'd face her, and went about my day. That night, I forgot all about it and went to sleep early since I had school the next day. Well, I woke up again at exactly 1 a.m. I remembered what my mom had said and immediately thought, "Josie!" So I turned to face my door. I didn't have a physical door, just a curtain hanging from a rod. I heard a chair outside my room shift and then saw the curtain start to move like a breeze was swaying it. I panicked. I freaked out. I turned toward the wall and pulled my blanket over my head. This was real and I couldn't handle it. The room got very cold this time. I stiffened, started shaking, and began to cry. Josie sat on my bed and gently placed her cold hand on my shoulder. Then I heard a faint whisper. "There, there." It was her voice. I stayed frozen, jaw clenched. It seemed to last much longer than the previous nights. Eventually, she got up and walked out. The room warmed up again, but I stayed curled up, soaking my pillow in tears. I wasn't going to turn around or get out of bed for the rest of the night. Morning couldn't come fast enough. I stayed awake and in shock until about 4 a.m., when I heard my dad's alarm clock go off. He always got up early for work. As soon as he turned the lights on, I got up and ran to him, telling him everything that had happened. He saw how shaken I was, red eyes from crying, and I'd never been up that early in my life. He believed me immediately and told me not to worry. He said my mom would light a candle in my room for Josie while I was at school. I honestly can't believe I managed to go to school that day, especially after getting no sleep. Later that afternoon when I got home, my mom told me she had lit a candle in my room, and that was it. I never woke up at 1 a.m. again, so I guess Josie was finally able to follow the light and rest in peace. After that experience, I was left in awe, and I absolutely believe in spirits. Story 5. This story may be short or it may be drawn out. I'm recounting these events as I type because it was honestly one of the most horrifying things I've ever experienced, and it brings me genuine stress just thinking about it. This happened maybe 2 to 3 years ago. I live in southern West Virginia and have for my entire life. The woods and mountains surround every direction you look, and nighttime brings a kind of darkness you can't truly imagine unless you've lived through it. I was with a friend. I'll call him Mark. He was at my house one evening. We were doing the usual, watching UFC, playing Xbox, just hanging out. It was extremely late when we finally got bored and decided to go for a walk on a nearby trail to smoke a joint. This isn't a particularly long trail, but it's very dense with the woods around it, and it's easy to get freaked out if you start thinking about your surroundings too much. We got about halfway down the trail, around 30 minutes in, where we stopped, lit the joint, and stood talking. The forest was incredibly active that night. There are always noises in the woods, but the sheer amount of animal activity felt unsettling. It was probably past 1 a.m. at this point. Strange, but not alarming. We figured maybe a predator nearby was stirring things up. We finished smoking and continued walking when, almost immediately, the forest fell dead silent. And right after that silence, there was a voice. It sounded like a mocking, humanoid voice, shaky and unnatural. Almost like one of those old children's toys with the crackly speakers and robotic voice, if you know what I mean. It immediately set us off. We bolted in the opposite direction down the trail, but the voice didn't fade. It didn't get closer exactly, but it also didn't get farther away. No matter how far we ran, the voice stayed at the same volume. It just kept repeating, never stopping, never changing. At that point, I felt we were in genuine danger. A kind of primal fear I've only felt a few times in my life. Finally, after running for what felt like forever, we reached the edge of the trail, gasping for breath and nearly in tears from the sheer terror. But just when we thought we were safe, about 5 minutes from the exit, there was a scream behind us. Not just any scream. It was bone-shaking, heart-stopping, and absolutely blood-curdling. It wasn't a mountain lion. I know what those sound like. This wasn't an animal. It wasn't a prank or a movie playing in someone's backyard. This was a real horrifying scream that sent birds flying from nests and made my entire body freeze. It was the most depraved, violent scream I've ever heard in my life. This is a true story I've only told to maybe three people, and all of them brushed it off like I was exaggerating or making it up. I've never been someone to push paranormal beliefs, but I genuinely believe I encountered something inhuman in those woods. Story 6. Okay, here it goes. I have a medical background and a certification I rarely use, though I keep renewing it. Anyway, I volunteered almost immediately, thinking I'd be helping those who had survived Hurricane Katrina. That wasn't the case. Once the water started to recede, a few of us were assigned to locate houses that had bodies still inside them. If you've ever had to recover a body that's been lying in the heat and floodwater for days, or even weeks, you know the smell. It's similar to any decaying carcass, but worse. I can't fully explain it. Somehow it's sweeter. The only way to keep from vomiting is to use Vicks under and around your nose. It doesn't block the smell completely, but it makes it tolerable enough to get through the job. We had to go house by house in wading boots, searching for remains. Many had washed out to sea, but some were still inside the homes they had once lived in. If we found a body, we spray-painted a big X on the outside of the house. There was another guy I worked with regularly. I'll call him Jay. We got paired together almost every day. He was decent company and didn't get sick at the bad ones. One day we came up to an old shack. I call it a shack because it was barely standing, and it was in what had been a rough neighborhood. Right away, I got chills. Something felt seriously wrong. Not just the usual dread of finding a body. This was different. Some parts of New Orleans give off strange vibes. From what I understand, voodoo is still practiced in some of those areas. Despite everything in me telling me to turn around, we went inside. The first thing I noticed was the smell of decay. The second was something earthy, like mold. I looked at Jay. He was pale as a sheet. I could tell he felt it too. Then we noticed the bones hanging from the ceiling, small ones. I'd bet money they were from cats. There were strange beads and carvings in the bare wood of the walls. We made our way into what used to be the kitchen, and there, chained to a beam, was an old woman, or what was left of her. She had chained herself by the wrists, and her insides had spilled out onto the floor. The creepiest thing? Her face still looked alive, staring at us with a twisted smile that showed only worn-down stubs for teeth. My skin crawled. Goosebumps spread across my entire body. My neck hair stood on end. Then we heard it. The most unearthly, guttural cackling I've ever heard in my life. My fight-or-flight response kicked in. And Jay's, too. We didn't say a word. We just ran. We slapped an X on the house and sprinted to the next one. I don't know if that old woman practiced voodoo or what, but that moment shook me to my core. It still gives me nightmares. The people I feel sorry for are the ones who had to go back and remove her. Jay and I talked about it later that night when we got back to the hotel north of the area. He had heard the same cackling. We both agreed it had to be the wind or something. At least that's what we told ourselves. But deep down, I don't believe that. Not for a second. Story 7. Got lost in the woods for 8 hours as a little girl and saw something unexplainable. I grew up in a densely forested rural area in central Virginia, and like most kids my age, 10 at the time of this story, I spent a lot of time playing in and around the woods. My best friend and I had found a creek one day while exploring different deer trails through the woods. This creek we happened upon was a rare find and the perfect spot for us to play. It was wide and deep enough to swim in and had soft, mossy banks on either side to rest on after we got tired. The water was cool and clear, no copperheads and no mosquitoes because the water was constantly running. We were thrilled. After a few hours of swimming, we had to walk back home for lunch, but made plans to pack lunch the next day so we could have a picnic on the creek banks and spend the whole day there. The next morning, we set out for the woods around 1 p.m., planning to have the picnic first and swim after. We entered at the same spot as the previous day and followed what we thought was the same deer trail. It wasn't. At the point where we should have found the creek, we walked into a small clearing covered in huge, thick ferns. We had definitely never walked past this before. Being hungry and tired of walking, we decided to eat in the clearing. We laughed and played around, spitting watermelon seeds at each other. It was an absolute blast, and we were both in wonderful, giddy moods. That all changed as soon as we packed up and started to head out to find the creek. As we walked on, the woods began to feel darker and colder. We got skittish, and I noticed my friend kept glancing behind us. About a half hour in, we came across what looked like an overgrown bathroom, sink, toilet, and bathtub, all sitting arranged together and covered in ivy. It's not unusual to find strange things in the woods, so we made jokes to lighten the mood, calling it Bigfoot's bathroom. After another hour of walking and seeing nothing familiar, we began to panic. Instead of trying to reach the creek, we just wanted to find our way home, or at least out of the woods. I told her we should follow the sun, and eventually we'd hit a road or someone's property. She insisted on going another direction. We started yelling at each other, out of fear and, let's be honest, little girl stubbornness. I told her if she thought she was right, she could go her way, and we'd see who got out first. So we split up. Now, as an adult, I fully admit I was being a brat and an idiot. Worst possible thing we could have done. Not 10 minutes after splitting up, I heard someone walking behind me, maybe 100 feet back. I assumed it was my friend changing her mind, so I slowed down to let her catch up. But instead, whatever it was matched my pace. I slowed down. It slowed down. I stopped. It stopped. This went on for hours. I kept going back and forth in my mind, wondering if it was real or just in my head. I picked up a big stick, made sure it was sturdy enough to defend myself, and kept going. As the woods grew darker, I came upon something that made my stomach drop. It was Bigfoot's bathroom. I had just walked in a massive circle for hours, despite being sure I was following the setting sun west the entire time. Confused and frustrated, I sat on a log and screamed while slamming my stick into the ground. As I tried to collect myself, I heard footsteps again, getting closer. I yelled out my friend's name. No answer. Then after a pause, the footsteps started running toward me. I jumped up and bolted in the opposite direction. Now here's the part I usually leave out when I tell people this story. As I was sprinting through the woods, I heard what sounded like church bells. I looked up and saw the darkest, deepest cloud I've ever seen. In the middle, it was pitch black, like staring into space, and the gray surrounding it was swirling. It made me feel sick, like that dizzy nausea you get when staring through binoculars too long. What scared me more was that the bells were coming from the cloud. Loud, booming, vibrating bells echoing down from the sky. I froze. I felt dread so intense it nearly knocked me over. A voice in my head screamed that if I didn't run away from that cloud, no one would ever see me again. But I didn't want to run toward whatever had been following me either. So I made a sharp right and ran. It was now completely dark. I ran blindly through the woods, getting smacked by branches, gasping for air, tripping constantly. After what felt like another hour, I crashed into something low and went flying, hitting the ground so hard it knocked the wind out of me. As I lay there trying to breathe, I noticed the bells had stopped. My eyes adjusted to the dark, and I realized I had hit a fence. Grabbing it, I prayed it would lead me somewhere, and it did. I climbed over a hill, maybe a mile up, and came to the back of a farmhouse. I explained what happened, and the farmer kindly gave me a ride home. I was covered in scrapes, bleeding, and more exhausted than I'd ever been. But I was safe. It was past 9 p.m. when I walked through the door. My friend had gotten home shortly after we split and assumed I had too, so she didn't tell anyone I was missing. My family just figured I was still out late, which wasn't unusual for me. They were shocked to see me crying and beat up. Nobody had been looking for me at all. To this day, I wonder how long it would have taken for them to come looking if I hadn't found that fence, and whether it would have been too late. Story 8. I've commented on a lot of posts about my experiences, and every time there are people messaging me, wanting to talk about it or ask questions, somehow they never respond again. But I figured I'd make an official post to share what I've gone through and some of the knowledge I've gathered over the years. It's going to be a very long post, so I hope you can bear with me. It all started when my brother, father, and I moved into a three-story house with two apartments on each floor. The house was over 100 years old but well renovated. My new school was across the street, and there was a beautiful park nearby. It seemed like the perfect place to grow up. I was 5 or 6 years old. Even then, I saw shadows in the corners of my eyes. That went on for 10 years before I realized it wasn't just an eye thing. I was also extremely afraid of the dark. For some reason, I was terrified that Batman would appear and kill me. Looking back, Batman was a tall, dark figure, and that's important later. I've always been sensitive to energy and the paranormal. I think I sensed something from the beginning but didn't understand it. I also had depression and insomnia from a young age due to family issues, which made everything worse. By age 12, my mental health deteriorated. I started cutting myself. After finishing school at 15, my sleep cycle was ruined. I was usually awake at night and often didn't sleep at all. I became constantly sleep deprived. Then strange things started to happen. Objects disappeared and reappeared months later. Stuff fell off shelves. I began hearing voices calling my name, usually my dad's or brother's, only to realize they weren't home or were asleep. Then things escalated. I heard gurgling noises like someone choking in the living room. Strange music woke me up at night, fading slowly from the corner of my room. There were three knocks on the wall. Unholy screeches. Loud footsteps, mostly from the attic above our apartment, like someone was throwing furniture around. It was constant. My friend and neighbor Natasha and I started investigating. She and her brother Peter had also been bothered by the entity. Their guest room seemed to be its starting point. The energy in that room was suffocating. I couldn't even step inside. Eventually, I tried to communicate with it. Big mistake. I gave it attention, and it latched on to me. I was a perfect victim, full of negative energy, which I later learned was what it fed on. One night, I saw a shadow in the corner. A black silhouette of a cat jumped off my bed and evaporated in midair. I turned around and saw it, what many call a shadow person or hat man. Mine had no face, no hands, no feet. It was about 2 meters tall, filled with dark, smoky energy. It stared into me before vanishing. That's when it got worse. I couldn't sleep. I was obsessed. It played mind games. It shattered light bulbs every 2 days. We were poor and couldn't always replace them. I was awake all night in darkness. It knew I was scared. At around 2 to 4 a.m., it was most active. Once I stepped into the kitchen before turning on the light and felt something beneath my feet. I flipped the switch. Maggots were everywhere. They disappeared into the walls even though there were no cracks. Another time I spoke to it all day, begging for sleep that night. When I laid down, the energy shifted. I felt hands around my throat. It choked me for minutes. That was the only physical attack, but it was enough. I reached out online and found someone who helped me. He weakened the entity, and for a few years things were quiet, but it still lingered, draining my emotions. I believe it pushed me to attempt suicide at 16. There were other reasons, but it was a major one. Nobody believed me. My dad ignored it. My brother sensed it but stayed quiet. I felt alone, completely traumatized. After my suicide attempt, I went to a clinic and met my future best friend. We tried using a Ouija board, but it only lied and fed off attention. 2 years ago, it returned. I was lying in bed with my partner, and I saw the living room light flick on, then off again. That was one of its old tricks. I panicked. My body shook violently for hours. I contacted the same person who had helped me before. We spent months planning to trap the demon in an object. He ended up doing something even riskier, but it worked. The demon is gone. At least I believe it is. I no longer feel that connection, but only time will tell. Story 9. I was 8 years old when we first moved into the house on the edge of the forest. My parents had their doubts about buying a home with a backyard bordered by woods.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal.
Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Lowe's knows how to set off your July 4th with savings. Right now, buy one, get one free on select one-coat coverage interior paint via Visa gift card rebate. Plus, get two select 2 or 2.5-quart red, white, and blue annuals for just $10. Hurry, these July 4th deals won't last long. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, excludes Alaska and Hawaii. More terms and restrictions apply. See Lowe's.com/rebates for more details.
They were concerned about wild animals getting into our trash or hurting our dogs and worried one of us kids might wander too far into the trees and get lost. But the price was right. My dad liked the seclusion. My mom loved the house itself. And my siblings and I were excited about having a huge backyard to play in and the forest to explore. The first sign that something wasn't right was that our dogs were absolutely terrified of the forest. They never went into it for any reason. If a toy they were playing with ended up past the tree line, they would refuse to retrieve it. And when one of us went in, they'd pace anxiously until we returned. Sometimes they would stare into the forest in distress, growling or barking at something none of us could see. One time, my brother tried to carry one of the dogs into the trees to show her there was nothing to be scared of, but she wriggled free and sprinted back into the house in a panic. If we were outside near sunset, we'd sometimes hear noises, like someone walking through the forest, sticks snapping underfoot, branches moving. If we called out, we got no response. But if we used a flashlight, every so often we'd catch a glimpse, just a flash, of something that looked like a person moving in the dark. My parents eventually banned us from going into the forest after dark entirely, and even during the day, we weren't allowed to go out of sight of the house. My sister's bedroom faced the backyard and the woods beyond. She once told us she saw a shadowy figure standing right at the edge of the forest late at night. She said there was something off about it, like it wasn't quite touching the ground, like it was a little too tall to be human, and the edges of its shape were distorted. She was convinced it was staring directly at her. She called out to our dad, saying there was a man in the yard looking through her window. He ran outside with a flashlight, and she kept her eyes on the figure the whole time. It didn't move, but the moment his light swept across it, it vanished. We regularly heard knocking on the back door at night, but no one was ever there. My parents figured it was teenagers playing pranks and eventually stopped opening the door altogether. That changed one rainy night when the knocking was especially loud and urgent. My mom pointed out that maybe someone needed help, so she opened the door, only to find no one there. Not only that, but there were no wet footprints on the porch. The knocking came and went the entire time we lived there. It might happen a few times over a couple of weeks, then stop for months only to return again. My parents eventually installed a security camera. There was never anyone on the footage, but the camera wasn't completely useless. 3 years after moving in, my brother began having night terrors and started sleepwalking. He would always go out the back door and head straight toward the forest. My mom, who was a light sleeper, would hear the door open and run outside to stop him before he went too far. After the third or fourth time, he asked to see the camera footage, curious about how he looked while sleepwalking. What we saw was chilling. He walked out onto the porch, then stopped as if listening to something. He shook his head, then slowly moved forward, like something was pulling or guiding him. One evening, my dad was in the backyard when he heard my sister calling to him from the forest, sounding like she was in trouble. Thinking she had wandered in and gotten hurt, he ran in after her, calling her name. But the forest was too dark, and he couldn't tell where her voice was coming from. He shouted that he was going to grab a flashlight and told her to stay put. When he got back inside, he found my sister sitting safely in the living room, completely unaware of what had happened. At the time, none of us kids knew about this. So when I heard my mom's voice calling to me from the forest a few months later, I didn't think twice. I was outside with the dogs one evening when I heard her call my name, saying she had gotten her sweater caught on a branch and needed help. I headed toward the trees, but the dogs began barking wildly. My dad saw me from the window and came running out, shouting. I told him I was just going to help Mom. He yelled back that Mom was inside and told me to run back immediately. I did. After that, my parents had a fence built around the backyard and started looking for a new place to live. In the time between the fence being completed and us moving out, things escalated. The knocking on the back door became more frequent, and we also started hearing tapping on the windows, as if someone was circling the house, checking each one. There were constant scratching and scraping noises at the fence, and we sometimes heard voices on the other side. My brother's night terrors intensified. One night, my mom didn't hear the door open, and he woke up standing at the fence, staring into the trees, while the dogs barked furiously at whatever was beyond it. The last morning we spent there, just under 4 years after moving in, we woke to find the back door wide open. The security footage showed it slowly swing open by itself.